Once again, I welcome you on behalf of the working staff of the Black Cat, the most famous bohemian bar in the world.
This is J.D. Doyle for Queer Music Heritage, and on this segment of the show, I'm taking you back to the San Francisco of the 1960s, and I'm bringing you interviews and recordings by two of that city's most colorful personalities, both female impersonators. But just calling them that doesn't begin to explain their contributions. In the intro, you heard Jose Saria starting a show at a club called the Black Cat Cafe in 1962. By that time, Jose had already been an entertainer and early community activist for many years. I credit him with recognizing the need for organizing the gay community and for helping to found several organizations that did exactly that, such as the League for Civil Education, the Tavern Guild, and the Society for Individual Rights. In 1961, he was the first openly gay candidate for public office in the United States, and one of the reasons for running was to get gay people out to vote and therefore become aware of the need to organize politically. A further step was in 1965 when he founded the Imperial Court System. That grew to over 70 chapters across North America, which over the decades have raised millions of dollars for charity. One of Jose's counterparts and close friends is a larger-than-life performer going by the name Michelle. He and Jose often performed together, and Michelle was particularly known for starring in many of the shows organized by the Society for Individual Rights, also called SIR. These theater-like productions were another way to bring together a community in San Francisco. And of course, he emceed countless benefit fundraisers during those years. One unique accomplishment was that a vinyl LP was released of one of the shows. This was a musical written especially for Michelle, and it was a double-disc recording. As far as I can tell, this was a first. I am so pleased to bring you interviews with both Jose and Michelle. That's been a dream of mine for years. I'm starting with Jose, and this is a treat. I even got him to sing a little. I began the interview by asking him to talk about when he began performing in drag in the gay clubs.
I started performing when I came back out of the service in 47, 47, 48.
Where was this? What clubs?
Well, first I performed at the Beige Room. I worked for Lynn Carter.
Really?
Yes. He was in San Francisco and he needed a, while he was changing clothes, what do you call that? He needed a, I would sing a song or two. Then he would come out and do his act.
Kind of like an intermission act?
That's exactly what it was. It was the intermission. Lynn Carter.
I read somewhere that the female impersonator, Michelle, gave you some encouragement.
Yes, he's the one that told me to go and try out for the amateur hour, which was in Oakland, and I won. I won the contest.
Was the prize an engagement at the Beige Room?
Yes. $50 a week and three shows a night, three songs a night.
How long before you started performing at the Black Cat?
Then I began at the Cat after his run was over, which was closer to 47, 48. And I didn't really perform. I'd get up and sing when I greeted people.
I understand that you were a customer and you did on-the-spot entertaining and they decided to hire you.
Yeah, that's what everybody did there. Yeah.
What was the clientele like at that time? Was it a mixture of men and women, races, ages?
It was what you would call a bohemian bar. There was no such thing as a gay bar. It was a mixed crowd, bohemian.
What was your typical show like?
Oh, after I developed a routine, I go around and greet people and sing a song, tell a story, read the newspapers in my way. Then I became the spokesperson for the police department, and pretty soon I was the leading queen of the city.
And you did operas. Which one was your most popular?
I began with Carmen. I sang Carmen in 15 minutes with all the songs. Then Butterfly became very popular. I had a repertoire of, well, you name them, I did them. Every week, a new opera. And they were written like in Esperanto.
And you did this until the bar closed in, I think, what, 62 or 63?
Yeah, 63. And then I done it afterwards. But then the crowd changed, you know what I mean? That's a long time to run a show. Then I went to work at Finocchio's.
How long did you work there?
I worked there two stints, twice, a year, and then I would go off to the World's Fair, and then I'd go again.
I want to interject that I spent a lot of time at the GLBT Historical Society when I was in San Francisco in June, and since for me it is the Historical Society, during my interview with Jose, I did not use the full title, but we both knew what I meant. So I'm correcting that before I go further. There is a San Francisco Historical Society, but it is not the same as the GLBT Historical Society. There, that settles that.
I went to the San Francisco Historical Society a couple months ago and did some research on you, and in one of your files I found cutouts in the shape of a cat that said, "I'm a boy."
Yes.
What was that about?
Well, in the early days, Halloween, you could be arrested after midnight because the law reads with the intent to deceive. And those silly bitches, they thought they were real. So at midnight on Halloween, the paddy wagons would hit the road and arrest you because you looked too much like a woman. You understand?
Mm-hmm.
It was plain harassment. So the law reads, for a man to put on clothes of the opposite sex with the intent to deceive is against the law. And so, if you let them know what you are, you're not deceiving them. You know, the police would stop you. So I figured out, so a police officer would stop a queen at 5 minutes after 12. And if you said, "I am a boy," they wouldn't dare arrest you because they would be open for a lawsuit. So that ended that harassment.
And did you hand those out at the Black Cat?
Yeah.
Tell me about the song, "God Save Us, Nellie Queens."
Well, music unites people. Music always unites people. We had to have a theme song. And so I changed the words to "God Save the Queen, Nellie Queens." And that was it.
They sang that at the bars at the closing?
At the closing of my show. And at the closing of my cabaret. I wanted people to stand up and acknowledge who they were and why.
I don't suppose you could sing a line of that for me, could you?
Yes. God save us, Nellie Queen. God save us, Nellie Queen. God save the queens and lesbians, too. I had to add that in because they got upset. From every mountainside, long may they live and thrive. God save the Nellie Queens. God save the Queens. That is the national anthem of England, you know.
Right.
And when the sheriff of London Town came, he sang it with us. It wasn't showing disrespect. It just changed the words.
I'm going to interject that if you've seen the 1978 documentary Word Is Out, you may recall one of the men named George telling about the singing of that song and how it became a song of pride against the police harassment and oppression of that time. From the film, here is George's memory of it.
It was the beginning of my awareness that I was not only a gay person, but that I should come out of my person and be, in a broader sense, aware of other gay people and their rights, too. Because Jose would say, let's unite, you know. We must realize that the Vice Squad is here, that they used to, at that time, they used to park their, the Vice Squad in the 50s used to park their police cars outside of gay bars. There were only two or three gay bars in town at that time. And they used to take down the names of people when they entered. They used to come in and stand around and just generally intimidate people and make people feel that they were less than human. And it was a frightening period. So I'm very stirred by this because at that time there was nowhere to go for your freedom. And you were very much aware that there was no freedom, that your freedom was in the gay bar. But when you got out on the streets, you had to be Mr. Straight or Miss Straight. At that time, this was strictly a men's bar. There were no women in the bar, as I recall. And but Jose would make these political comments about our rights as homosexuals. And at the end of every concert, he would have everybody in the room stand. And we'd put our arms around each other, and we would... We would sing, God save us Nellie Queens. Now that sounds, I know I get very emotional about this, and it sounds very silly, but if you lived at that time and you were aware of the oppression coming down from the police department and from society, and that there was nowhere to turn, to be able to put your arms around other gay men and be able to stand up and say, God save us Nellie Queens, we were really not saying, God save us, Nellie Queens. We were saying, we have our rights, too, is what we were really saying.
I want to talk about your record album, because I've had that a long time and have played that on my show. How did the recording come about?
Well, there was a group of black people that needed to promote and raise money for their church. And they came to me at that time. I was a very big star. And they said, if we could record you, can we then have the rights to the record? I said, yes, anything to promote. So they came and they recorded at the Cat, and they had the rights for 20 years. We sold quite a few records, close to 1,000 records. And after 20 years, and I had the rights.
I understand there was discussion with the record company about doing a second album.
No. A lot of talk, no action.
When I was at the Historical Society, in your files, there must have been 12 or 15 letters between you and that company. And
it was called the Ball Company.
Yes, that was it. Interesting reading. To kind of sum up some of the research I did on you, you were amazingly political, and you were a co-founder.
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
You were a co-founder of the League for Civil Education, the Society for Individual Rights, and the Tavern Guild.
Yes.
And to me, what these all have in common is that they were important in uniting the community.
That's right. My purpose was that I wanted the community not just to raise money. I wanted the gay community. Number one, there's no such thing gay. It's human rights. And the community, they were trying to separate themselves. And I said, no, you're gay. You're going to be part of the community and you have to work together. There's no such thing as a gay community. There's a human rights. And that's what I fought for. Now they're human rights long before Martin Luther King started.
You also made history by running for public office. What prompted that decision?
Well, I figured that the only way get people out there to vote, you're only going to change the laws if you vote. The Queens at that time didn't vote. Stupid idiots. So the only way to make them vote was to run and to get people to vote.
So if they were voting for you, they would be voting for other things.
Yeah, the laws of the land.
And you used the Black Cat as your campaign headquarters?
Yeah, that was it.
Also, one of your major accomplishments was founding the imperial court system.
That came later in 65.
It must be amazing for you to look back and see how much it's grown and what it's accomplished.
Yeah, that was another try to unite the community.
What would you like to be known as your legacy?
Well, that I did a lot more than run for public office, and that I did change the atmosphere of the people, that I was a human rights fighter.
Kind of uniting the community where there really wasn't one.
No, there was no. They were going around saying they were gay. Well, what's gay? Gay is ha-ha, hee-hee. I want to be remembered for some of the good things that I've done. Letters that I've written to parents, and parents are writing to me.
I'm going to let you hear an entire side of Jose's LP, but I'm saving that for the end of the show, as I want to get to my interview with Michelle. And I very much thank Jose for providing me Michelle's contact information so I could request the interview. I began the same way as I did with Jose by asking Michelle how he got started doing female impersonation.
I got to San Francisco in 1954, and I was inspiring. I thought I had the talent to be a stand-up comedian, and I wasn't really fully, I knew I was gay, but I wasn't fully out yet, you know. Anyway, there were different amateur hours at different gay bars, and I signed up for a bar called Pearls in Oakland, California. And that was my first appearance. It was a little, almost like a speakeasy. They rang the bell if the cops were coming. It wasn't even, you know, in those days, it wasn't even called gay yet. There was no such thing as a gay bar. That came after Stonewall. Anyway, there was a contest there, and I won it. And it was just a very little teeny club. And from there, I just got interested, and I found out it was just very easy to perform in drag. That's really just how it started.
What other clubs did you perform at?
Well, after Pearls, then I went back into the city, and I worked at a place called Ann's 440. And then I got a job at a female impersonating club on Broadway called the Beige Room, and I worked there.
I'm curious what the customers were like at the Beige Room. Was it a mix?
The Beige Room was mostly tourists.
Like Finocchio's.
Exactly, but on a much smaller scale.
So it wasn't really a so-called gay community hangout?
No, definitely not. Finocchio's wasn't either. Finocchio's was 99% tourists, and gay people would bring, you know, like their parents there or someone. Finocchio's was never a gay hangout or a gay place. It was strictly, you know, tourists. And in its heyday, it just packed them in three and four shows a night.
You mentioned Ann's 440.
Ann's 440 was a little teeny club in North Beach off Broadway where later on some really big stars got their start there. Johnny Mathis worked there. Barbara Streisand did a little shot there. It was a very little teeny place that was run by a woman named Ann. It was Ann's 440. Again, straight. As far as the drag part, I was like a little fill-in, just like a little MC fill-in thing.
So drag was not really a big part of Ann's 440?
No, not at all. Not at all. Those were just a few of the things very, very early. What happened later is with the creation of Sir is when gay theater really started. That's when full productions of legitimate theater started. And the first big show that I was in, full male cast, was The Women. And that was put on by Sir.
I have a program from one of your shows called Michelle International.
Okay. That was, but does that have a date?
62.
Oh, wow. Is it that long ago? That's before The Women.
And it was sponsored by League for Civil Education, which I think may have become Sir.
Right. You got that right. Did Jose ever say anything to you about me working with him in The Black Cat?
Yes.
Okay, I did that. I did parodies with him there. I did shows on Sunday afternoon the same time as Jose worked the cat. And we were friendly competitors. We had a lot of fun. Would be like Jack Benny and Bob Hope, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
People thought we were enemies, but we were very, very dear friends. And people would go from one show to the other. It was a lot of fun.
Was he performing before you got to San Francisco?
Yes. I think the answer to that is yes. He was performing at the Black Cat. I got to San Francisco in 54, in the fall of 54. And I met Jose, I would say, within the first year. And all I can recall that he was doing was Sundays at the Black Cat. I was with him in the celebrity capades, but that was just a review. You know, Jose would do a number. I did a number. Franklin did a number. There was a chorus. They were great shows. They were just great shows. I guess those things I did first. I did the bar shows. I did Michelle International. And then we started with the legitimate theater. Well, not legitimate. You know what I'm saying.
Full-scale productions.
Full. Not little crappy things. Full costumed shows. I would say the first one was The Women. That would be the first book show I did. Legitimate book show. The other shows I did were my own. Stand-up comedian and stuff like that.
How often did you perform?
I performed almost every Sunday somewhere.
One of the things I noticed, you know, looking at the Michelle International program from 1962,
yes,
is like they never mentioned the words gay or homosexual.
Because, babe, the word gay, honest to God, was not out yet. To my knowledge, no one was gay till after Stonewall. We were queer. We were never gay. We were homosexuals.
Well, the program didn't use the word homosexual either.
No. That might have been because of me, because I hated that word. Hated that, and I hated queer, and I hated Mary, and I hated fag. I hated all of that. Michelle International was a great show. That was just me on stage. No script, no nothing. I'd come back from Europe, and I just sat there and talked. It was a great show.
Did you personally experience any police harassment?
Yes, definitely. Definitely. Yeah, I was arrested 3 times. They called it, you know, impersonating a woman. But it was, you know, it was Halloween. Wasn't like I was using a public restroom. You know, it was Halloween. It was allowed to a degree. But then there were a couple of years they really, really, really cracked down. There was one Halloween. If you believe, I don't know if anybody ever told you this, but we had to wear a button that said, I am a boy.
I've heard about that.
Yeah, you could be dressed like, you know, Queen Elizabeth, but you had to have a button on. The first arrest, yeah, first arrest, very important. I was doing a big benefit in a gay bar called the Jumping Frog on Polk Street, and it was a huge benefit. The police came in and busted the bar and took me to jail. That was my first time. And then I got busted on after that twice on Halloween.
Do you know what years those would have been?
Oh, boy, oh, boy, oh, boy. I would say early 60s, mid-60s. And they hauled me off three times.
Next, I'm going to ask Michelle about the record album. But I want to share with you a bit of it first. It was a show from 1967 of production numbers and stand-up comedy called Ready or Not, It's Me. I've got the LP and program for the show, which you can see on my website, and they show lots of photos of Michelle and the cast, including a quite good-looking group of 20 singers and dancers called the Escorts.
Fasten your seatbelts and hang on tight. Ready or not, it's me. Everything is gay, okay. We're gonna make it a holiday. So all aboard, let's get underway. Ready or not, it's me. Send a rocket out into space. I will beat it and win the race. Life is so grand and it's just like I've landed on Boardwalk and Park Lane. Feeling so spectacular. I'm flying high and I'm going far. So brace yourself, kids, be like a star. Ready or not, it's me.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Oh. Welcome to the village and my big debut. I finally got off the bars and the beer boxes and onto a decent parquet floor. And I'd like to certainly explain to any heterosexual that sneaked in here tonight that I am a boy. We'll get rid of that problem right now. And then, of course, I got in other trouble this week, too. You all were surprised, I'm sure, in your mailbox this week by the little things the assessor's office did, weren't you? But I marched right down to City Hall and protested. I said, how dare you assess a little cottage on the hill with just a few sprigs of ivy crawling around the front window. I said, what do you mean upping me $400? He says, we didn't assess your house, we assessed your closet. So I went down, and the lady I got at that front desk was a winner. She said, we have a whole record on you, Mr. Hmm. Notice how careful I was not to tell you my last name? You're not going to write my mother and tell her everything. Do you believe my poor mother still thinks I'm in the Navy? But anyway, I just protested absolutely fantastically. Because I just have a funny little house, you know. On the outside, inside, it's gorgeous. But that's none of their business. If there's anyone in the house that's completely infatuated with me, don't be embarrassed. We have one stairway over here for your convenience. And one over there, and I have a wedding gown and a minister waiting in the back. And we'll learn to see if we're compatible later. If you don't like me this way, I'll take a bath. If I don't like you the way you are, you can put this on. And don't think I haven't had that happen. Most of you go home and, you know, you lose razors, electric razors and a little hi-fi. Well, honey, those things are easy to be replaced, but when you lose a silver fox and a pair of your best earrings, it hurts. Anyway, ladies and gentlemen, when I did come to San Francisco, immediately following the Donner Party, you know, every time I say something old, you all sit there like a bunch of mutes. You know, we're not all 16. I'm just a scooch over 30. Just a hair's breadth. Now, you know, listen, the years are going to come and go, hon. You know, face up to it. Just put a little more glue on. I have a mile of mucilage tire around my body this evening. And you can't even see the two rubber bands behind my ears holding my mouth open, can you? And I've got this wonderful thing that I erase everything with on my credential. My driver's license has a hole in it where it says age. I don't think it's any of their business when you go through a red light how old you are. Anyway, ladies and gentlemen, one of the first things I did when I came to California was I went down to the Veterans Administration. Oh, what a gasp that was. I said, I want to go to school. And they said, what kind? I said, haven't you read your brochure? How many could I get into? And so I did. I went down to the veterans and I went, yeah, because I figured, you know, I had served my time. Not completely, but I served my time. You know. Well, I know a lot of you that have those funny papers at home, too. Can you imagine anybody saying with their right mind that I was undesirable? Lots of smiling people on my ship. And no, she did. She was so sweet. She came in. She didn't even look at me twice. How could she? She fainted. And I said, I want to be a hairdresser. And she said, really? That comes as a great shock. Oh, I do terrible things to my customers. Wild horses couldn't make me tell you about, but I'm going to. Oh, I really. But my women come in, you know, and if I'm just not ready for it, so I put the dryer down over the head just as fast as I can. Sometimes I don't even set the back because I forget. I figure, you know, because they always say to me, I don't look at the back, I don't look at the back. I said, today I'm going to test you. It's soaking wet. Let it hang there. Let your husband look at it at 6 o'clock in the morning. See how pretty he thinks an old permanent wave is hanging around your eardrum. Yeah, come over here to my chair and let me notch your hair, you dirty old lady. So anyway, and I stick him under, and then, you know, then the next one comes in, then, you know, there are other women under the jar, and they say, good morning. But, you know, the hot air is bursting their ear drum. They can't hear you. And they say, good morning, Michelle. They know me very well. They say, good morning. I say, you dirty son of a bitch, good morning. Morning, you ugly, rotten old lady. And she says, I'm fine, thank you. How are you? But anyway, that's what I do during the day. I keep a lot of people, I guess, fairly satisfied with deep finger wave right down the back. You don't think I'm going to make them look as pretty as I do you? This lady said to me, she says, you know, you didn't set my hair tight enough. I put a curl in her hair, honey. I took that clippy out, shot right through her throat. I said, is it tight enough, Shirley Temple?
I want to talk about your record albums.
Okay. The record album was made. I can give you their names because they're dead and buried. No one would ever mind. The records were produced by Ron Morano and Gordon Beeler. They wrote Ready or Not, It's Me, an original musical for me. And it opened at the Village, a nightclub on Columbus Street. Do you have that program?
Yes, I do.
You do? Oh, well, that's got a lot of pictures in it and everything, right?
Yeah,
oh,
yes,
that's a
yeah.
Wonderful program. Well, that's self-explanatory. That'll tell you everything.
Were Ron and Gordon gay?
Oh, yeah.
And were they a couple?
No. Collaborators together, you know, like, the partners. Ron wrote the music and Gordon did the lyrics. It was just fabulous. Do you have that record?
Yes.
Oh my God, that's like ancient.
The comedy on your album, I think, especially considering it's 40 some years old, is not really dated.
All the humor, this is the part people don't believe. Everything I did in that record, everything, is ad-lib.
Really?
I never had a script. The show had a format, but it would alter each night depending on my audience. I fed off my audience. The musical numbers were rehearsed backwards and forwards. The costumes, the choreography, that was all rehearsed. But all the talking, everything, I would just stand up there and do it. And that's what all my shows were like. I never had a script. I would just walk out there.
How many times did you do that show, Ready or Not, It's Me?
Oh, I would say total 20. But we packed them in. That was unheard of. This was a straight nightclub. We rented it. We had to beg them for that. It was a beautiful nightclub on Columbus Street. Big stage and round tables and a balcony.
And they recorded one of the shows?
Oh, they recorded a lot. And the record you have, the reason the quality isn't, you know, you can almost hear the splicing. We took tons and tons and tons of roll-to-roll tape and edited it to make the record. So it could be the highlights of various shows.
And the music was written for the show?
The music was written absolutely 100% for me and the show.
And David Kelsey did the arrangements?
And David Kelsey did the musical arrangement, exactly.
He was pretty prominent. Could you talk a moment about him?
Oh, David was a big star. He played the piano in the organ in a lot of the gay bars. Or he got a very big following, usually in Sundays with the big ones, down at Jack's Waterfront, places like that. He also played, you know, during the week at the piano bars. And he always had a big crowd. He was very, very popular.
He released an album.
Yes, I think he did. You're right. He was a great guy. Super guy.
Now, I've seen ads for another show called It's Me Again.
Exactly. That's the second Ready or Not It's Me. I guess a year or two later, Ron and Gordon again wrote another show starring me again called It's Me Again. At the same place, back at the Village, the whole schmush. Do you have that program?
I have the program. I understand the album was never released as such.
No, exactly. You got that 100% correct. We never got an album out on that one.
Did you know that some of the material was released, though?
Some of the... From It's Me Again?
Yes. They put out an album called Here's to Us. And it had songs from Ready or Not, It's Me. It had 6 songs from It's Me Again. And it had 5 songs from their musical called A Fair Exchange.
Wow. Well, they wrote an A Fair Exchange. But who did they write that for?
It was not a gay musical. This was kind of their greatest hits album.
I don't remember that at all. And did they put it out?
Yeah, I have a copy.
You're kidding me.
No.
What's on the cover?
A picture of them on a beach.
Gordon and Ron.
Yes.
My God. You know, I absolutely, absolutely do not remember that. All right, so the songs from the first show, Ready or Not, It's Me.
Whoever in the cast did those numbers, that's who it was.
Well, then it would have been me, because 90% of the numbers I did. My goodness.
So it has essentially half of the It's Me Again show is on that album. Just the music, not comedy.
Just the music. Can you name one of the songs that's on it?
In just a second, I can get it up on my screen because I've got it on my website.
Okay. I can't believe I never heard of this.
Okay. From It's Me Again are the numbers Tell It Like It Is, Here's to Us.
All right, let me stop you immediately. Mm-hmm. Here's to Us is me and that 20-boy chorus.
Right, the Escorts.
Yeah, there you go. You know a lot. Oh, isn't that interesting?
Here's to the sad, sweet thrill of the chase. Here's to the mad, impossible thing. And here's a toast to the gay times. Bittersweet cabaret times. Here's to a ball, don't think how it ends. And most of all, let's drink to our friends. So raise a glass to each other. Here's to us and what we are.
Here's to the past and yesterday's you. Here's to the present's festering crew. And here's a toast to tomorrow. And the love we must follow. Here's to the damn that none of us fears. Let's raise a glass to each other. Here's to us and what we are. Here's to those wild and wonderful years.
And there was a song called Lovely Me.
Right.
One called Opening Night.
Okay.
Oscar Time.
Oh, my goodness.
And Night People.
It's Me Again was good. But it wasn't as good as Ready or Not, It's Me. Ready or Not, It's Me, you know, it was just magical. It was so, so far ahead of its time. It was so far ahead of its time. It wasn't a gay show. It had gay undertones, but, you know, straight people loved it. Loved it.
Here's to Us album was 1970. It's Me Again. My information says 1969, and Ready or Not is 67.
Wow. Well, you're right then. Wow, wow, wow. Isn't that interesting? Well, you cleared up that for me. that long ago. My God.
And so the album didn't get released, but they released this like their own greatest production hit, sort of.
Wow, wow, wow.
Tell me about the Hello Dolly show.
All right, the Hello Dolly show, that was produced by, yeah, Sir did that, Society for Individual Rights. Sir produced that. That opened up at the, we did a very small but complete version of the Broadway book, the Broadway show, the Broadway music. We opened it at the Sir Center.
And then the Village after that?
And then we went to the Village, and then we went to the Kabuki Theater. We did Hello Dolly 3 times. You know, looking back, it was so unbelievable because we had such cooperation, you know, from the talent in the community. The sets were unbelievable. Costumes were gorgeous, just drop-dead gorgeous. And huge cast. And we followed the book to the T. We didn't cut out a thing. If we did anything, we exaggerated it because, you know, men were doing all the female roles. So, you know, was probably exaggerated. More colorful than, you know what I'm trying to say. Mm-hmm. It wasn't just a little tacky review. Costumes were gorgeous. People just couldn't get over that show.
When did you stop performing?
When did I stop performing? Let's see. I came back here in 1985. After that, I didn't do any more book shows, but I emceed a lot of events in San Francisco, a lot of gay events, put it that way.
A lot of benefits.
A lot of benefits and gay stuff. I'm positive I came back to emcee the Beaux-Arts Ball for Halloween. And I also think I came back and emceed the Closet Ball. You've heard of both of those affairs.
I've heard of the first one, for sure.
You didn't hear the Closet Ball?
No.
God, that used to be fabulous. That's one of the best things they ever did. They would take, regular guys like a bartender or just, plain old guy. The more masculine, the better.
And do turnabout.
Exactly. They would come out in the first half as a guy, and then I think there was an hour intermission, and they had a sponsor, a makeup artist, and they had 1 hour, and then they came back as the female version.
Yep.
It was, honest to God, fabulous. Those were great, great shows. I know I came back for a Beaux-Arts Ball, and I remember I came back for a Closet Ball, and I think that's really the end. You know, I had done Dolly. I did all the Michelle shows. All of that was done. I did a couple of, MCs. Finocchio's was, honest to God, the last thing I did. Finocchio's? Wow, wow, wow. When the hell did I work at Finocchio's? I know one way if you have computers and Google and all that garbage. if you can find out when Queen Elizabeth visited San Francisco.
Maybe.
All right. But if you can Google Queen Elizabeth's visit, I remember that I did a little stint on that. So that would determine the year I was there. I don't know how else to tell you when the hell I was there.
Okay. I can probably find that.
I had already sold my beauty shop. I was done. And I did a stint there. That's probably the last thing I did in San Francisco. Then I came back probably 86, 87, to do those 2 shows we just talked about.
Now, yeah, Queen Elizabeth visited in 1983.
When, dear?
83.
83?
Mm-hmm.
How did you find that so quick?
Googling.
Wow. All right, because I remember working in Finocchio's and saying that Queen Elizabeth came into the harbor and waved from the bow of the ship, and 5 million queens waved back. It was a very funny line. I worked there as an MC. That was the last thing I did.
How would you like to be remembered for your performing as Michelle?
How would I like to be remembered? Well, I would certainly like to be remembered as a, there's a word I'm looking for here, not a pioneer, an innovator, my friend just said. I was never afraid to put myself on the front line. Let me put it that way. I feel that I was a history maker.
This is J.D. Doyle, and it has been a thrill for me to interview both Jose and Michelle for Queer Music Heritage. And I'm so pleased that it worked out that I could present the interviews both on the same show. I thank them both for putting up with my questions about their lives from 40 to 50 years ago. Now, as promised, is more of Jose's album from 1962. The LP is called No Camping, and he shares it with a couple other artists, kind of an odd combination. He had two of the four segments, and on the other two were a fortune teller and a person interviewing women of the night in Tijuana. Well, I'm just pleased some of Jose's entertaining was captured. His banter with the audience was always a large part of his act, and early on, you'll hear him sing a little opera, along with a bit of A Good Man Is Hard to Find, with quite different lyrics.
I like to do a number, and I like to dedicate it to the men in the house, entitled A Good Man Is Hard to Find. A good man is hard to find. Years again, the Nelly Kai. And when you think that you got a he-man, you find him drawing pictures in the walls of the woman's can. Then you hope and then you pray that little monkey be in its gray. Now listen, girls, you take my advice. You kiss him in the morning, you hug him every noon. Well, I think with Olive Girls, don't give them a lot of room. Cause a good man nowadays is hard to find. I said a good man is hard to find. You usually wind up with the Nelly Los Angeles kind. And when you think that you've got a real he-man, everybody had him last night at the YMCA camp. And then you hope and then you pray the little monkey be in his garay. Now listen, girls, you take my advice. You kiss him in the morning, hug him every noon, and don't say no to him, or I will do him soon. Cause a good man nowadays is hard to find. Okay, when did you two young boys come in? My goodness gracious. Where are you from? Monterey? Oh, there's nothing like the sands of Monterey at 2 o'clock in the morning. It's gay down there. Do they still have that roving patrol out there, though? Oh, yes, they are. Well, there's nothing so gay as the roving patrol at 2 o'clock in the morning. Oh, Lord. Drive carefully, or are you staying in town tonight? Oh, you're staying in town? May I ask the name of the hotel that you're staying at? Oh, come, come. Whisper in my good ear. Which one is it, the Embarcadero or the Golden Gate Avenue? Yes. Yeah, Golden Gate. 503 and 504. Wow. Connecting door, you know. Yes. Lovely. Oh, it's so gay. Well, Oh, I kind of missed you girls up here. My goodness gracious. This young man works for the IBM, but I don't want this news to get out beyond our doors. How's everything over there at IBM these days?
I don't work for them.
Shut your hole, Mary, otherwise I'll know where you really work. Here I'm being diplomatic, and she... Mercy!
Mercy!
Ladies and gentlemen, while I still have a little time and while you all are so quiet and attentive, I'd like to tell you that tomorrow begins the very first of the new series of opera to be presented at the Black Cat. Tomorrow's opera, ladies and gentlemen, will be The Magic Flute. All those that have never played on a magic flute, please come down. We're going to make a cooperative institution tomorrow. But at any rate, it is a very, very gay opera. It's an opera written by Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart, and it's a satire on the Masonic order. It really is the forerunner of modern-day operetta, believe it or not. There is no recitatives in this thing. And by a recitative, you probably don't know what a recitative is. Do you know what a recitative is?
No.
You don't?
No.
Well, I'll tell you. Hazel, play something, and we'll do a recitative for them. You can imagine that just before this takes place, the heroine has discovered that she's a lesbian and she's knocked up. She is beside herself with perplexity. And so she thinks to herself, and this is what she says.
Je ne sais pas pourquoi je suis knocked up. Dites-moi, qu'est-ce que c'est le bouchon? Peut-être demain, peut-être aujourd'hui. La 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 la, je ne sais pas. Oh la la, gorgonzola, pasta schulta.
You see, by this time, she's thought it all out. She's going over to Oakland to get some of those knockout pills and clear the whole situation up. That is what a recitative is. Well, in our opera tomorrow, you will not hear any recitatives. It is going to be straight off the shoulder. No one gets knocked up but the hero. Oh, I think that's gay. Oh, yes. Well, now, so don't forget, at 4:30, you will see the magic flute. Costumes have been executed by that one and only, the Mad Russian. They were designed and executed about 4 years ago, and I shook the moths out of them, and they're still in good condition. Oh, no, I never throw anything away. I have to have them when I turn in my income tax form. Oh, yes. Ladies and gentlemen, I have another little story that I like to tell you. And this happens to deal with a unique bar. And you know, a bar is unique because of various things. The paintings on the wall, the type of clientele that come there, the working personnel. Such was the case with this bar. It had a unique piano player. He could play any number anyone could think of. And also, there was a little monkey. A little monkey that used to sit on the shoulders of the people and carry on and do various things. One day, a young gentleman in a red vest came in and ordered, don't you turn around, Mary, I'm talking about you, and ordered a very, very exotic drink. The bartender made it and served it in an open glass. He was so proud of his fantastic drink that he sat there and admired it and he played with it and he fingered it and Oh, he did a lot of things with it. His drink. And then he excused himself and went to the restroom. While he was at the restroom, ladies and gentlemen, the little monkey perched himself on the rim of this lovely drink with his testicles hanging on the inside. Can you imagine this? It's very hard for our dear friend from Idaho to imagine. Evidently, they don't have gay bars there. But at any rate, ladies and gentlemen, and my dear friend, when the gentleman came back and saw his drink, he was completely distraught. He looked at his drink and he screamed. He said, "My goodness, look what that monkey's done to my drink." The bartender said, "Don't tell me your troubles, Mac. That monkey does not belong to me nor the bar. It belongs to the piano player. If you have any complaints, go and tell him." So he got up from his stool, went over to the piano player and tapped him on the shoulder and said, "Hey, Mac, do you know the monkey's got his testicles in my drink?" The piano player, who was very busily playing, said, "Never heard the tune before, Mac, but if you hum it, I'll play it for you." Looking in the audience, I find so many people wearing glasses, and I like to tell a story about glasses. There was a woman that was losing her eyesight, and she was quite perturbed over the fact that she was losing her eyesight and she was still a young woman. So she went to the doctor, and the doctor said that he would examine her eyes to see if there was something that could be done to correct this malady. So he told her, he said, "My dear, I want you to stand on that wall while I stand at the other wall, and I will hold cards up, and you tell me what letters I have on them." So he held up a rather small card, and she looked, and she said, "Doctor, I can't see a thing." So then he held up a bigger card, and he said, "Now tell me, madam, what do you see?" She squinted, and she said, "I'm sorry, doctor, I can't see a thing." He backed away from the cards. He pointed to the wall and he said, "Now, madam, tell me, what am I pointing to?" She looked, she squinted, she passed wind, and she said, "I can't see a damn thing, doctor. I'm losing my eyesight." And she became hysterical. The doctor thought a while and he said, "One more test, my dear." He stood in front of the wall, unzipped his zipper, and he said, "Now, madam, tell me, what do you see?" She squinted a little bit, and a little smirk came over her face, and she smiled. She says, "Yes, doctor, now I can see." He says, "Madam, there's nothing wrong with your eyesight. You're just cockeyed, that's all." Right now, ladies and gentlemen, I would like to tell a story which I haven't told in some time. And it's a success story. As you know, success is something that we all wish to achieve. And it is very difficult sometimes to achieve it. However, in Los Angeles and in Hollywood, it is very simple to achieve. You either have to have money, know somebody, or be very talented behind closed doors. Such was the case with these two queens that went down there and became the most successful extras Hollywood had ever seen. There was never a motion picture made that these girls did not appear. And at the height of their career, a movie director was going to close his making of pictures, and he decided that he would go to the Bible and make an epic picture from the Bible. And out to Death Valley he went, and he constructed the Colosseum, stone for stone, mortar for mortar, glory hole for glory hole. I'm so glad everybody understands what I'm talking about. Well, naturally, our two girls got a job as extras. They were Christians. And as they went out to Death Valley to become great stars in this epic motion picture, they were fitted in silks and satins, and naturally, being true queens, they sashayed up and down in front of the cameras to let everybody see how beautiful, how gorgeous they were. All of a sudden, the movie director got ready. He said, "Camera, action!" And then the camera began to take this epic picture. Our two girls were down in the middle of the arena, busy sashaying around, unaware of the fact that realism was going to be the keynote in this picture. For in back of them, out of a trapdoor, there they opened, and there sprung, ladies and gentlemen, the most ferocious, the most man-eating pussycats you ever seen. These animals jumped out, and they snatched, and they grabbed, and they tore. Ooh, it was a gay scene, that's all I can say. But our two girls were still very busy sashaying in front of the cameras. They didn't realize what was going on. All of a sudden, one turned around, and as she did, this ferocious lion was just about to snatch her. That sounds bad, doesn't it? And she grabbed her tail and she ran for the other end of the arena. And as she was running, she passed her dear sister, who was running in the opposite direction with a pussycat on her tail. And as they passed one another, one said to the other, she says, "My God, Mary, who do we screw to get out of this picture?"